Well, ladies and gentlemen, Governor, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome you all to this, the second Bank of England lecture to be held at the LSE. And it gives us a particular pleasure to welcome the new Governor to deliver this lecture, appropriately timed for the budget as it is. Eddie George, known to one and all as Eddie, hope you don't mind, was educated at Cambridge, something that I told him we can always correct a little since we're very much into adult education these days here. But he graduated in economics in 1962 and then joined the Bank of England immediately. And he remained at the bank ever since, although with spells of, as it were, sabbatical, working first in Moscow State University, where he studied Russian, then thus developed an interest in Eastern European affairs, and then subsequently to the International Monetary Fund to work as the personal assistant to Sir Jeremy Morse, and so on. In March 1977, he was appointed Deputy Chief Cashier, concerned particularly with the management of the gilt-edged market, and then, March 1980, appointed Assistant Director in charge of the gilt-edged division of the bank. In 1982, he was appointed to the Court of Directors as Executive Director with responsibility for monetary policy, market operations, and market supervision. In 1990, he was appointed Deputy Governor. And then finally, of course, in January of this year, he was appointed to a 5-year term as Governor of the Bank of England. It's with very great pleasure that we welcome him here to the LSE tonight to deliver the second Bank of England lecture entitled The Pursuit of Financial Stability. Eddie.
Thank you, John, for that kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, a year ago, my predecessor as governor inaugurated this series of lectures with a discussion of the case for price stability. Tonight, I have the different but related theme of financial stability, the stability of the institutions that make up the financial system. In this lecture, the word crisis will crop up almost as much as stability. On the whole, I dislike the word crisis. Its supply has increased too fast, and so has its velocity of circulation. But that much devalued word does properly describe what can happen when pressure in a financial system gets out of hand. No central banker can be relaxed about that danger. But I hope that you will be able to relax this evening while you listen to me worrying. What I'll be dealing with is practical reality of the kind that makes headlines and moves markets. The developing country debt drama, the United States savings and loans saga, the worldwide stock market crash of 1987, the Drexel-Burnham affair, the tensions affecting banks abroad from the United States to Japan and Scandinavia, the strains on small banks here in the United Kingdom. All these are recent examples of financial pressure and all raise questions about how central banks can and should respond. Tonight, I will not just list the questions. I'll also try to answer them by explaining the principles that guide us through the minefield of incomplete information and uncertain consequences. These principles are often misunderstood. I dare say this is largely our own fault. We've typically been very coy about this area of central banking. And that's a pity. The powers of central banks carry with them a duty to account for how they're used. And it's in that spirit that I offer you these thoughts this evening. Let me begin with a basic point. Why should I, as a central banker, think that financial stability matters. My answer to that is that monetary stability can't be divorced from financial stability. The line that leads from monetary policy to the health of the financial system is pretty clear, so let me deal with that first. Abrupt or unexpected shifts in monetary conditions are a potent cause of financial disorder. The most recent stresses in the world's financial system stemmed largely from rapid growth in credit during the mid and late 1980s, which in time produced excessive demand, rising inflation, including a big inflation of asset values, and finally, inevitably, a sharp change in policy. The need to tighten policy was beyond doubt, but the effects, much higher interest rates, were enough to invalidate many of the assumptions which had seemed to justify the earlier rapid increase in lending and borrowing. The result was painfully clear. Many marginal borrowers, who'd geared up quite easily during the boom, were unable to meet their servicing commitments or to renew short-term loan facilities. And the corresponding fall in the asset and collateral values of the banks and other financial intermediaries threatened some of them as well. I could, of course, develop this theme, but I hope I've said enough to acknowledge that financial instability can often be born of official misjudgment. Nostra culpa. Though in mitigation, I should point out that we're never short of willing accomplices. Without doubt, the main thing that central banks can do to ensure financial stability in the sense of tonight's lecture is to maintain monetary stability in the sense of last year's lecture. Now let us consider the line that runs the other way, from financial health to monetary policy. Here, central banks have several concerns, one of which has to do with their own effectiveness. They operate through firms and markets to transmit monetary policy to the real economy. If those firms and markets are unstable, then the policy itself will be less effective than it might be. But that concern needs to be seen in a wider context, which comes from the essential characteristics of banks as providers of monetary intermediation to the rest of the economy. On one side, the liquid liabilities of banks and building societies are money. One can argue about degrees of moneyness, but for my purposes now, it may be enough that people regard a deposit as money because it can normally be used to make payments or normally be turned into an obligation of the central bank. On the other side, the banks are still the overwhelming providers of finance to the rest of the economy. Their loans are illiquid, so because their liabilities are largely liquid, they're taking a risk. This willingness to take on the risk of maturity transformation is a main source of the value added of the banking system. Competition will mean that some institutions expand at the expense of others, and for the efficiency of the system, it's vital that they should. Occasionally, a particular bank will find the competition so tough that it fails, without any serious implications for monetary stability in the macroeconomic sense. Those sorts of failures are essentially isolated hiccups. They can happen, but before they do, the central banker always has to consider the possibility that the failure will spread, affecting other banks. The reasons are plain. A loss of confidence might be contagious, and some of the liabilities of one bank are almost bound to be the assets of another. Through the interbank market, banks are substantially exposed to each other, and the interbank market is enormous, roughly £654 billion in the UK alone. This explains why a financial failure can be quite unlike an industrial failure. If a shoemaker goes bust, there's no particular reason to think that other shoemakers will also fail. In fact, they will expect to attract more business. But if a bank fails, things may be quite different. Although it's true that some visibly stronger banks may benefit, others may fall under a cloud of suspicion, either because their businesses are linked through the interbank market, or because the problems one has encountered are presumed to affect others with similar assets or liabilities. The foundation of the banking system is credit, yet a banking failure may mean, in Badgett's words, that instead of credit, there's discredit. Unlike with shoemakers, the liabilities of banks are typically short-term, often callable on demand. Their assets are longer-term, and generally they have no ready market. This makes it extremely difficult to realize them quickly, at least not without paying a large penalty. All these features mean that panic can be quick to spread, and once it's taken hold, hard to halt. The potential for such contagion has increased with the evolution of the financial system. Crises can spread not just from bank to bank, but also from country to country. And today it's not only banks that can cause difficulties. A major international securities house, for example, can take large positions in many markets. Although in theory these assets may be self-liquidating, in an atmosphere of crisis, the counterparties of the securities house may take fright. Then financial markets are disrupted, and the effects feed through to undermine the normal workings of all commercial life. As the potential for contagion has increased, so too have the risks of individual financial failure. All financial firms now operate in a highly competitive environment, encouraged by, and in turn encouraging, better communications and technology, and the development of new markets, instruments, and techniques. Although many of these changes provide the means of dispersing or diversifying risks, they also allow greater risks to be taken on. And there are obvious dangers that some of the newer risks will not be properly understood or managed, and that they will be mispriced in an atmosphere where judgments are coloured by a perceived need to build up a book. I'm not complaining about these developments. The financial system has evolved as it has, presumably in response to the needs of the wider economy, which wouldn't be prepared to pay for the services unless it found them useful. I simply want you to understand the nature and complexity of the challenge that confronts us. In meeting this challenge, central banks don't see it as their job to eliminate risks and put the financial system in cotton wool. No doubt the authorities could use their powers to shape the system in that direction. If society wanted a largely risk-free financial system, they could indeed produce one. But this would be only at enormous cost by constraining financial intermediaries to such an extent that they would be able to provide far fewer of the services to industry and commerce that they do now. Even well short of draconian controls, any intervention of central banks is bound to affect the shape and dynamics of the system. This raises difficult questions about the appropriate balance between risk and stability. We see it as our task to provide a regime in which the users of financial services can benefit from robust competition among financial firms, which will not happen unless each individual firm takes on some risk. But at the same time, we must ensure that there's public confidence in the monetary system as a whole. In short, lots of small uncertainties must add up to an overall certainty. Now, this is difficult arithmetic, and we achieve it in essentially two ways. First, through supervision. In conjunction with financial regulators, we try to prevent the emergence of general financial pressures. And secondly, when such pressures do arise, we try to contain them through direct central bank intervention acting, if necessary, as lender of last resort. Let me deal with each of these in turn. First, prevention. This can take different forms which are not mutually exclusive. At one end of the spectrum, there's the idea of narrow banks, a special class that will be constrained to invest only in high-quality, fully marketable assets, and which alone would be able to join the payment system and have the assurance of official arrangements for deposit protection. Depositors who wished to participate in the returns available from the riskier aspects of banking would then do so through institutions which would be closer to unit or investment trusts. It's fascinating to speculate about such arrangements, and although I'm personally skeptical about how they might work out in practice, we are following that debate with interest. For the time being, as practicing central bankers, we have to deal with the markets as we find them. Moving along the spectrum, there's one area where structural change can realistically reduce risk, and that's the payment and settlement system. The trend towards real-time gross settlement of large value payments, made possible by improvements in technology, and which will be introduced in this country in 1995, will greatly reduce the involuntary exposures that banks take with one another in the payment system. And the realization of delivery versus payment in securities and eventually in foreign exchange will greatly reduce risks in those markets. From there, I move on to the familiar end of the spectrum of prevention, the supervision of individual institutions. In this country, supervision grew out of the bank's direct involvement in markets, an involvement almost as old as the bank itself. In the 19th century, we were the central participant in the bill market, which was itself widely used by industry and commerce as a source of working capital. Like every active market participant today, we needed to know that our counterparties were sound and that the names on the paper we discounted were of good quality. Disruption to the bill market caused by the failure of a discounter of bills could produce commercial chaos in the same way as the suspension of all overdraft facilities might do today. So in the financial crises of those days, the bank acted as discounter of last resort to prevent disorderly conditions. Out of this developed our more specialized role as discounter of last resort to acceptors themselves, as for example in the Barings crisis of 1890. By the early 20th century, this role of discounter of last resort was fairly well established. The bank, either on its own or acting with other banks, supported some small retail banks, including the Yorkshire Penny Bank, Cox's and King's, and Williams Deacon's. Because of this involvement, the bank then took a direct interest in the financial health of those banks and had the influence and authority needed to exercise an informal surveillance of their activities. By the 1930s, the accepting houses were regularly providing information on their balance sheets to the bank. All this was just a shadow of what happens today, but a recognizable shadow nevertheless. Our surveillance was informal and non-statutory. It was based on our willingness to recognize a firm's acceptances in our operations, as well as the possibility, never more than that, of assistance if the firm got into difficulties. And this situation lasted for years, and neither the bank nor Parliament tried to bolster the bank's role by giving it statutory powers. Even the Bank of England Act of 1946, the main purpose of which was to take us into public ownership, was remarkably vague. It gave us powers to make recommendations to bankers or to issue directions, but none of this was considered to be a supervisory power. Rather, the Act was seen as justifying the qualitative lending guidance that was part of monetary policy in the 1950s and 1960s. It was the secondary banking crisis of 1973 to 74 that prompted a new look at the bank's supervisory role. At a time of acute uncertainty in world markets, a group of unsupervised fringe or secondary banks in Britain lent too much to the volatile property sector on a fragile base of wholesale deposits that suddenly melted away. The risk of contagion was there and growing. So too was the risk that the economy as a whole would be disrupted. In the circumstances, we decided to organize a support operation with much of the finance coming from the clearing banks. These efforts were successful in two senses. One, the secondary banks were able to meet their market obligations. Two, and more importantly for my present purpose, we managed to avoid any disturbance to the wider financial system. But the episode demonstrated the need for a more formal framework for the supervision of banks, and it led to the 1979 Banking Act. The main feature of that act was the requirement that all deposit takers be authorized and supervised by the bank. In a sense, the 1979 Banking Act simply recognized and codified the logic of previous extensions of supervision. As we'd come to feel responsibility for more and more institutions, so we'd taken a closer interest in what they were doing. But in the 1973-74 crisis, we'd put a safety net under institutions which were outside this informal surveillance and equally outside our quantitative credit controls. Under the old regime, they were in effect enjoying a free ride at the expense of the major banks and ultimately on the bank at the back of the Bank of England. That made no sense. Both competitive and systemic considerations meant that these fringe institutions should be subject to the bank's oversight, and the way to do that was through statutory powers of supervision. The 1979 Act had another purpose that I should mention. It was explicitly designed to provide a degree of protection for the bank's depositors. Indeed, it provided for compensation when a bank failed. Nonetheless, it established the principle that depositors should bear some of the risks if a bank failed. Only 75% of their deposit was eligible for compensation, and only up to a maximum payout of £7,500 for any one depositor. The 75% proportion was retained in the 1987 Act, but the maximum payment increased to £15,000. The scheme is financed by the banks in proportion to their deposits. This novel emphasis on depositor protection reflected an entirely legitimate social concern. The argument is that small and often financially unsophisticated depositors can't know enough about the affairs of the whole range of deposit-taking institutions to be able to make informed judgments about their reliability. Small depositors, therefore, need special protection. But that protection was deliberately, and in my view wisely, limited. The intention of the Banking Act is unmistakable. Banks can fail, and depositors can lose some of their money. Otherwise, if depositors were relieved of all responsibility, deposits would simply flow to the highest bidder, regardless of risk, which would undermine market disciplines and greatly increase the dangers of instability. Understood in this way, supervision of individual banks for the purpose of reducing the risk of failure and the risk of depositors losing money sits comfortably alongside supervision for the quite different original purpose of reducing systemic risk. The nature of the supervisory activity is essentially the same, and there's an obvious efficiency in conducting that activity as a single operation, but the objectives are distinct. The central bank's essential task in this area is to preserve the stability of the financial system as a whole, without unduly constraining the ability of financial businesses to service the wider economy. If too much came to be expected of our relatively new role in depositor protection, if, for example, the Bank of England authorization came to be regarded as a guarantee against failure of each individual institution, then our capacity to perform that essential task would be seriously and perhaps fatally undermined. So far, I've talked mostly of banks as though they were synonymous with the financial system. But even as extended by the Banking Acts, it's clear that the Bank of England's direct prudential supervision doesn't cover all the financial firms that are systemically important, or even all the systemically important domestic financial firms. In these circumstances, it's reasonable to ask why we concern ourselves particularly with the stability of the banking system. The conventional answer is that the line of financial instability will typically run through the banking system, even though it may not originate there. This is because the liquid nature of the bank's liabilities leaves them still peculiarly vulnerable to a loss of confidence, and because of the dominant role that the banks still play in the payment and credit systems. To me, this answer remains essentially valid, even though I recognize that the previously sharp distinctions between different forms of financial intermediation have started to blur over the past decade and more. But it doesn't mean that the central banker is not vitally interested in what goes on outside the banking system. If I can take one example, the stock market crash of 1987 prompted the closest collaboration between bank and security regulators nationally and among banking supervisors internationally, which helped to maintain relative calm. And in another case, the difficulties of Drexel Burnham, a US securities house, we and other central banks had to intervene to assist in closing out Drexel's positions. This involved no risk for us, but it did give some vital assurance to Drexel's counterparties. They were able to pay out money owing to Drexel in one currency in the knowledge that what was owed to them had already been paid to us in another. In this way, we eased a potential logjam in a number of settlement systems. This kind of collaboration seems set to grow, and supervisors will need to adapt to reflect evolving market structures. Supervision is also a powerful defense against systemic instability. Through setting and monitoring minimum standards for capital adequacy, liquidity, and concentration of risk, we can ensure that banks have a cushion against developing pressures, which gives them time to respond. We also use the supervisory process proactively to draw attention to pressures often before they hit individual banks and to encourage them to prepare themselves. They can do this by strengthening their liquidity or scaling down their business to the levels of liquidity likely to be available to them. This was the approach we adopted recently when some of the smaller banks came under pressure in 1991 and 1992. A measure of its success is that for the group of 40 banks we thought vulnerable to the contraction of the sterling wholesale markets, their total assets declined by over 25% between the end of 1990 and the end of 1992, and yet very few got into actual difficulty. But not all such pressures can be avoided by prophylactic supervision. It's then that we consider acting as lender of last resort. Now, the phrase itself is liable to cause confusion, so let me first clarify what it doesn't mean. As I've explained already, we don't see it as our job to prevent each and every bank from failing. The possibility of failure is necessary to the health of the financial system, as it is to the efficiency of all other economic activity. If I can quote Badgett again, any aid to a present bad bank is the surest mode of preventing the establishment of a future good bank. We need those cautionary words, if only to refute the notion that a bank failure necessarily represents a failure of banking supervision. But when a bank does seem likely to fail, the central bank must at least consider the option of supporting it. The Bank of England frequently does no more than that. We think about support, but we decide against it. There have in fact been 9 bank closures since 1987, and the majority of them proved unable to meet all their liabilities. But there are circumstances when we may decide that were an institution not to meet its obligations as they fell due, that would pose a serious threat to the financial system as a whole. I should emphasize here what I believe is a crucial but often misunderstood point. If we do decide to support a particular bank, it's not because we carry a flag for that bank as opposed to others. Our involvement is not designed to give special protection to its depositors or to safeguard the position of its employees. Nor is it based on a wish to help its shareholders or management, who should indeed expect to be penalized. I'm reminded of the wise central bank governor who, confronted by a banker with a tale of woe, replied, "Thank you for telling me about your bank's problems. I look forward to discussing them with your successors." Of course, our support may help the bank and its various stakeholders, but this would be essentially as a byproduct of meeting our wider objective. The only issues for us are A, what effect the failure of the institution would have on the system as a whole, and B, what should be done to protect the system from contagion. In reaching a decision on support, we take care not to be predictable. Central bankers have raised unpredictability to an art form, so that the phrase constructive ambiguity has become rather popular in our circles. But it's essential that no one, should expect support as a matter of course. I often hear it said that some banks are too big to fail, that some occupy such key positions that their failure is almost unthinkable. And it is indeed true that size is an important factor in considering systemic effects. Even so, I have to say that there's nothing automatic about our acting as lender of last resort, and even if we did decide on support, no bank should assume that it would be immune from penalty. In practice, systemic dangers have tended to originate among the smaller banks. The central bank then has to decide how best, that is, with least damage to the financial system, it can stop the rot. There are no hard and fast rules, and there can't be any. At one extreme, imagine an institution that's in difficulty for internal reasons, poor credit assessment, for example, or weak lending controls, or even fraud. And in addition, imagine there's no suggestion of wider financial fragility. In those circumstances, we would consider, as supervisors, whether there were possibilities short of closure that would be in the interests of the bank's depositors. But it's highly unlikely that we'd intervene as lender of last resort. At the other extreme, an institution might have had an unexpected loss of either retail or wholesale deposits because of some wider concern. Perhaps there were severe financial problems in a particular industry with which that bank was closely associated. If a series of other banks could be affected by those same factors, and if those banks had large direct commitments to other banks, then we would be more inclined to conclude that direct support was justified. In reality, of course, most cases fall rather awkwardly between these extremes. In the case of our recent intervention, we had, during 1990, been conscious of growing pressures on a sizable group of smaller banks. They had some retail deposits, but they were generally heavily dependent on large wholesale places of funds, building societies, local authorities, big industrial companies, as well as other banks. All of these were under pressure of some kind, and withdrew funds from the wholesale markets. Foreign banks, for example, reduced their sterling claims on UK banks from over 110 billion at the end of 1990 to less than 76 billion 2 years later, those figures in dollars. Meanwhile, the assets of the smaller UK banks were becoming increasingly vulnerable to the recession, particularly as it affected the property values supporting their loans. In early 1991, three small banks, Chancery, Eddington and Authority, closed their doors after significant loan losses that were followed by a shrinking of their deposits. At that stage, we saw no clear evidence of systemic fragility, so we didn't intervene. The wholesale markets continued to tighten. This process accelerated when BCCI was closed later in the year, trapping some large local authority deposits. Meanwhile, and there's always a meanwhile, for banking troubles always come in a crowd, there was, quite coincidentally, a run on a building society and growing talk of banks in difficulties overseas. As I've already mentioned, we had been engaged already in prophylactic supervision for some time. But as the bigger picture got more threatening, one particular institution did run into an immediate liquidity crisis. Its auditors couldn't certify that it had enough assurance of liquidity to allow it to continue to trade. It was then that we decided to provide support to that and to a small number of other banks. It is, of course, impossible to be sure what would have happened if we hadn't provided support in this or any other particular case. It's very easy to slip into the position of the man on the train to Brighton who kept snapping his fingers out of the window to keep the elephants away. Since he saw no elephants, he concluded that his technique was self-evidently effective. But in the early 1990s, we were quite clear that had we failed to intervene, the pressure would have spread, and we would then have found it harder to stop. It was the first time since 1973-74 that we'd offered such widespread support, and it's prompted us to update our thinking on the principles that should guide such operations. The overriding principle is not new, and I've already referred to it several times. Our support, whatever form it takes, is directed to safeguarding the financial system and therefore preventing damage to the wider economy, not to protecting the institution itself. Central bankers have to keep this permanently in the front of their minds, which is why I make no apology for repeating it now. Beyond that, there are various rules which we apply. First, we will explore every option for a commercial solution before committing our own funds. Initially, we will always look to major shareholders to provide support. Short of that, we will encourage the bank to try to find a buyer for some or all of its business, even at knockdown prices. Or a bank's major creditors may decide to provide support to protect their own positions. Or there may be a coherent group of other banks with a common interest in an orderly resolution. It's only when these options have been exhausted that we will consider providing support ourselves. And even then we may decide against it, as we did in the case of British and Commonwealth Merchant Bank in 1990. Second, central banks are not in the business of providing public subsidy to private shareholders. If we do provide support, we will try to structure it so that any losses fall first on the shareholders and any benefits come first to us. And any support we provide will be on terms that are as penal as we can make them without precipitating the collapse we are trying to avoid. Third, we aim to provide liquidity. We won't, in normal circumstances, support a bank that we know at the time to be insolvent. Our own capital is not there to be used as risk capital. But it would be wrong to conclude from this that loans or guarantees never involve any risk. Even if a bank is apparently solvent at the time we provide support, it can easily become insolvent later. When we supported the small banks in late 1991, their problem was one of liquidity rather than insolvency. As the impact of the recession on their balance sheets got worse, the value of our collateral fell until eventually we needed to make provisions against possible losses. Fourth, we look for a clear exit. The company may be required to run down or restructure its operations under our surveillance to the point where it can do without our support within a given period. Making the terms of our support as unattractive as possible has the great advantage of encouraging this process. Alternatively, the company may be wound down under our management, which is what happened to Johnson Matthey Bank and earlier to Slater Walker and many of the lifeboat banks. We aim to protect the system, not to keep in being unviable banking capacity and so interfere with the market process unnecessarily. Fifth, we usually try to keep the fact that we are providing systemic support secret at the time. In principle, I'm against secrecy for its own sake. And in this field, there can certainly be circumstances where the markets will be reassured by knowing that we are involved. Very often, however, the opposite is true. If people know that we are so concerned about systemic fragility that we've judged it necessary to provide support, that could lead to a wider loss of confidence. They'd wonder how far that support would be extended, and we could rapidly find ourselves in the position where we were in practice underwriting all the liabilities of the banking system. It would then be extremely difficult for us to disengage. We will, as a matter of public accountability, always reveal the fact of our support after the event, when the danger has passed. Even then, it will often be difficult to disclose publicly the details of our support. The full details could weaken even those banks that had succeeded in dispensing with our support. If we need to provide against possible losses in our accounts, we draw attention to that when the danger has passed. Although we're not required by statute to produce our accounts for Parliament on a Companies Act basis, we do so insofar as that is appropriate for a central bank. We aim to make minimum use of this insofar clause, but we did take advantage of it in not drawing specific attention to a small provision for our support operations in our 1991-1992 accounts. The Treasury knew of the provision, of course, but it wasn't until this year, in the 1992-93 accounts, which took account of the latest assessment of the likely costs of the operation, that we judged the small bank sector was again in calmer waters so that we could reveal what we'd done in the storm. The bank has a balance sheet of its own and it makes profits on its own account. A large part of our resources are provided by the banking system through the cash ratio deposits which the banks place with us. We use the income to finance the many activities which help to ensure a sound and well-functioning banking system, and those activities sometimes include support operations. But our money is nevertheless public money in the sense that if we make provisions that reduces our profit, then our payments of tax and dividends to the Treasury are reduced. Our decisions are decisions of public policy. They're sanctioned by our Court of Directors, who are appointed by the Crown to oversee the affairs of the bank. They're discussed with the Treasury as our shareholder, but we don't seek formal Treasury agreement. If it were ever necessary to provide support on a scale that would strain our own balance sheet, that clearly would be a matter directly for the Treasury. The Bank of England's role in preserving financial stability and acting as lender of last resort has tended to be somewhat obscure. I've spoken about it tonight in some detail because I believe it needs to be properly understood. Although we sometimes have to play it in great secrecy, it's right that we should try to explain what we do and how we do it. I hope that I've cleared up at least some of the misunderstandings. The central bank has a vital duty to support the soundness of the financial system. We're clear about our objective. It's not to prevent each and every failure, but to ensure that when a systemic threat arises, it's dealt with quickly and efficiently. We have the ability to do this because we know a lot about all the institutions and markets through which threats can materialize. We get our information largely from the process of supervision, from being a direct supervisor ourselves and through our involvement in the markets, and through our contacts with other supervisors at home and overseas. And in our central banking role, we have the resources to do this job, not just money, but also the technical skills to manage out difficult positions and the reputation for impartiality, which enables us to coordinate commercial solutions. I also hope that I've stimulated some of you here tonight to fresh thoughts on this whole topic. I've tried to describe our approach, but I'm well aware that the ground on which we stand is shifting all the time. We need to be open-minded about the future, as ready to consider new ideas as we are to accept new market realities. I conclude as I began. Financial stability, like price stability, is a public good. Central banks must pursue both objectives because they're mutually dependent, and they must explain their objectives and account for their performance. What I've said tonight, and what my predecessor said here a year ago, represent an attempt to explain and account. I hope that at least in a small way, we've helped to make the Bank of England's role better understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor, for that fascinating insight into the life of the Bank of England and for so nicely complimenting last year's lecture. Well, as those of you who've been to this lecture theatre before know, it's the tradition here, wherever possible, for us to ask our invited speakers to answer questions, and the Governor has very kindly agreed to fall in with this tradition. And so, when he's got his notes in order, I'll ask him to come back here before the microphone, and we will have a question and answer session for some 20 minutes or so. Some of our students look as if they have to go to other lectures, alas. But Eddie, I think it'd probably be best if you could come here, just so that you could use these electronic things, which are doubtless connected to something somewhere.
I'm sorry.
Could the VCCI have been saved by early action and joint action by international?
I think it's extremely unlikely that there could ever have been a case for intervening to save BCCI through last resort assistance. By that time, I mean, what we discovered was extremely far-reaching fraud. And I think one could imagine circumstances in which it could in itself have actually caused a serious systemic problem. But as a matter of fact, the circumstances applying to it were so unique and were seen to be so unique that I think it's very difficult to imagine that we could have done that, or that would have been politically acceptable or acceptable socially. Could it have been saved by earlier prophylactic supervision? I think that's a much more difficult question to answer, and Lord Justice Bingham, I think, investigated that pretty extensively. Certainly, I think we have to accept that there were things that we could have done better, but over an episode extending for 20 years, I would think that it would be quite extraordinary if he hadn't reached that conclusion in some degree. Of course, had we actually appreciated the extent of what was going on sooner, then possibly something could have been done. I think actually the debate is over a really rather narrow time perspective, and I suspect that even if we'd known about it 6 months earlier, in the degree that we did in July, I suspect it was then too late. If I could just amend the question slightly. I would absolutely agree if you'd said Germany apparently has a separation between the monetary policy and the supervisory function. The reality, I think, is not as straightforward as that. I mean, in fact, the Bundesbank is very much involved in supervision, I mean, indeed, very often conducting it and collecting the statistical data on behalf of the Bundesaufsichtsamt. So that it's an important correction to the question, if I may say that. And it's precisely because I think the Bundesbank accepts the same sort of responsibility for the stability of the system as we accept, that I think they feel they have to be involved to that degree in the process of supervision. The depositor protection dimension of supervision, which, as I say, is relatively new in all of this, of course that does fall much more clearly onto the supervisory authority in Berlin. Having said that, I think the second part of your question essentially falls away. I think it would be accepted within a single system of European central banks, that system had between it responsibility for preserving systemic stability. It wouldn't mean that it necessarily was involved in the depositor protection dimension of supervision. I'd say one other thing, and that is that I acknowledged, I think once or twice in the lecture, that we have to evolve with the times. Marketplaces are changing all the times. So that I think the precise institutional arrangements for doing the supervision could very well evolve over time. And I wouldn't be dogmatic or doctrinaire about that at all. I think that could take the thing in either direction. What's really important from the point of view of systemic stability is not the precise institutional structure, the precise regulatory structure at any particular moment in time, but it is that all the potential for instability is overseen in one way or another, and that there's close cooperation between the different groups of regulators. And that structure, I think, can and will change over time. Perhaps I could repeat it. As I understood it, the question was, would I accept that the 1987 stock market crash was the result of intervention by the central banks, which removed instability and volatility from the foreign exchange market and transferred it to the stock market? I think I'd need to consider that question for a long time. All I can say to you is that I certainly wasn't conscious of that origin at the time. I mean, going through the process and seeing the way in which the stock market crash built up, the very strong rise in equity prices, followed by a turn and then the very rapid decline. It certainly didn't strike me that that was actually connected or originating in anything that the central banks were doing in the foreign exchange markets at that time. I'd have to research the question much more carefully to give you a full answer. I have to say I've never heard that suggested as being the cause before this evening, which is why I hesitate really to be categoric about giving you the answer. I'd also say that we didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the origins at the time. We were too busy dealing with the consequences.
That's the problem with the UK's government.
Having influence with the banks as an obstacle, you say having influence with the banks, yes, we do have some influence with the banks. We have to persuade them, but...
Does the government's interference with you...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Really
want
to know whether you would like to be independent.
Well, I wondered if that's what we were getting around to. Let's be clear about that debate. That debate is in relation to the monetary policy side of the bank, much less concerned with the supervisory side. And although some people have sought to draw a link between the two, I think you'll see from what I've said this evening that at least systemic stability is an intrinsic part of the central banking function, so I wouldn't accept it to that degree. In the monetary policy area, I've said publicly, and I repeat again this evening, that the big question is stability. And if we can achieve that through the present sorts of arrangements, then I should be very delighted. The question of the institutional relationship between ourselves and government in the monetary policy area, I think has to be seen in the context of whether or not that would contribute to monetary stability. And I've also said that I believe that it would. And I believe that it would because it would provide reassurance, greater reassurance than we can have under the present arrangements, that the pursuit of stability would be time consistent. It would extend through time if that were embodied in a statute which gave us that responsibility. What it would mean for us would be actually very uncomfortable. We would be given a clear mandate to pursue stability, and we would be unambiguously accountable for achieving it. I would welcome that because I think that kind of accountability clarifies the mind wonderfully. And so I think it would be a good thing from that point of view. I think it would be a good thing from another point of view, which is that all of policy making is a balance of risk. It's very unusual for the way forward to be absolutely clear. If we had a mandate to pursue price stability, not for its own sake, but because there was a belief that that was actually the way to enable the economy to form best, if we had that clear mandate, then in making that balance of risk, there would be a tendency on average and over time, not possibly in any particular instance, but on average and over time, to take the risk in favor of stability. So that I think you would, in fact, get a result on balance, on average and over time, which produced greater stability. And I think the markets would believe that that was likely to happen, so that the costs of achieving that situation would probably be lower.
Thank you. Do you think that there has been a deterioration in banking practice, or is it just a symptom of all institutions now being questioned by the monarchy being back to the church? Because is it just part of the modern trend, or has there been effective deterioration in banking practice?
All of the above, I think, is the short answer to that question. I agree with you that the image of the banks, has weakened enormously, and I think that that's happened particularly during the course of recession. I don't find that totally surprising. I mean, in that circumstance, it's the banks that bring very bad news, and it can be very painful. Don't imagine that the banks, and certainly we, don't actually understand the pain that that causes. And of course, in those circumstances, people are liable to see these big fat cat banks being very unfair in relation to small people. That's a dimension to it. But I wouldn't feel that that's the totality of the reason for the bank's current image. I think they have, in many, many respects, been their own worst enemies, and I think they recognize that. I think they recognize that the service that they provide has not been what it should be, and I think they're making very considerable efforts to improve that. I think the answer to that is it can. I mean, in principle it can. There's absolutely no question about that. I would say myself that on the evidence that we've had in looking very closely into this question in London, it probably has. I think the worry is that it doesn't have to, and that any technique for diversifying risk can also be used by some players to actually aggregate and accumulate risk. And I think that's the nature of the worry about derivatives. There are other worries too. They can be, highly complex instruments. And so it's very difficult, A, to measure very often the nature of the risk, certainly to accumulate, to aggregate, so that a senior manager can actually have a confident feeling of how much risk the traders in these products have actually taken on. So that there's that worry about the manageability of the complexity of the risks. There are other dimensions too. It's pointed up quite a lot of problems about legal risk, uncertainty in particular jurisdictions. A lot of them are cross-jurisdictional products, so that there's uncertainty about that. It's pointed up problems about the settlements arrangements for some of these instruments, because they can be quite long-term forward contracts. So that there are lots of aspects of derivatives which I think do raise questions. I think the way we address those questions is to keep extremely close to the marketplace, to monitor very closely, to follow very closely what the market is doing in these instruments, to draw their attention to the kinds of dangers that we see, and to try to satisfy ourselves that they do have both the people and the systems to manage the risks properly. We've encouraged very much, for example, the Group of 30 analysis into derivatives, which was conducted by the key players in these marketplaces themselves. Now, we don't necessarily simply take on board the conclusions, but as an exercise in sensitizing them to, particularly the senior management, to the kinds of risks that could arise, I think it was extremely successful. We did in parallel our own investigation of a similar kind into the derivatives market in London. It's one of the things I like to do, is to ask senior managers when I come across them whether they know their rho from their gamma, and
when I get an astonished kind of look, then I say I think they probably ought to look into this question of managing risks in the derivatives market. I have to tell you, I don't know the difference between my role.
I was going to say, I'm tempted to ask for a show of hands.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman,
I think you're right.
Yes.
Well, that too is not altogether easy to measure. I mean, there can be on the asset side immediately repayable assets, which in practice people know aren't. So, I mean, put that on one side, whether one can measure it at all precisely or not, and I don't think one can. But of course, one does the best thing that we can. We do monitor very closely the mismatch between the maturity of the liabilities and the maturity of the assets at the level of each individual bank, and requirements, of course, take that into account. I don't think we have a view about what is an acceptable level of mismatch in that sense. I think that's essentially a decision for the management. I think we set minimum standards, and management will operate within those.
Just got time for one more yesterday. Do you have your opinion on the time scale of the European Union or the European
countries? For monetary union, I honestly find this extremely difficult. I think it will be slower than in the Maastricht treaty. If you're talking about it, I mean, across a wide range of the member countries, I think you could get a narrower form of union coming sooner rather than later. I frankly don't find it a very useful area in which to speculate. I think it's extremely clear what we currently need to do to manage the current situation. We do need to pursue the convergence criteria in the Maastricht Agreement as matters of, national self-interest, and we do need to do that individually and therefore collectively. I think if we do that, perhaps if we reinforce the convergence criteria by having an absolute objective for inflation rather than the relative one, which is in the Maastricht criteria, then I think that would actually deliver exchange rate stability in a de facto sense. And I think that's very important. I think we need monetary stability in Europe in order to make the single market effective. We need it to keep the single market, the achievement of the single market, to keep that from degenerating. So that I'm very clear on what we need to do immediately. I hope the European Monetary Institute will play an important role in focusing on the period immediately ahead. I think if one does that, then I think there will be plenty of time to actually see the way forward to monetary union and the likely timetable. So it's not something that I lie awake at night speculating about.
I forgot to say, Governor, that it's always the last question that you've got to watch out for. Well, you've given us a fascinating lecture. You can see how much we've enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed. And before I ask you to show your appreciation for the Governor once more, could I just say that it's actually quite difficult to get a large number of people in and out of this somewhat enclosed space. So I would be very grateful if you could just bear with me and just allow the Governor and Mrs. George and the Deputy Governor just to get out and into the lifts before you all dash for the door. Governor, thank you very much.